of Iowa. One, and I know we'll have anyway, whether I ask for it, a tremendous reception, because this is not only his first visit to Palm Springs, but his first visit to California. The governor of the state of Iowa, Harold Hughes. Let's give him a hell of a hand.
Chairman, distinguished guests, and ladies and gentlemen, hi.
Hi.
I greatly appreciated the invitation to come to California and address this particular group, and though the hours seemed to close in on me this past week and Maury offered me out, I am not sure what his intentions were, but he left the door open, and like any alcoholic, I thought, to hell with him. If he's trying to get rid of me, I'm going to be there. So here I am. I would like to express my personal appreciation to Dr. Marsh for his kind courtesies in letting me speak this evening and taking the afternoon program tomorrow. We never discuss anything other than our problems in AA at these particular meetings. I have some political philosophies I'd like to discuss about my session back home, but I'll refrain from that. To all of you displaced Iowans, a special greeting this evening. Iowa is changing, and in a couple of years, we're going to hold the Iowa picnic in Iowa. When Maury first contacted me some time back about this particular event and asked me if I would accept the invitation, I did. For a number of reasons, I thought I needed a rest. I knew that my wife needed a rest, and we made plans to take a leisurely trip out here and spend a few days in California and take a leisurely trip home. And I would like to inform you that Wednesday evening, I had reservations made for 4:37 Thursday afternoon for my wife and my youngest daughter. They were still packed at noon Thursday, and I hung on to the reservations till 3:15. And I called my wife with tears in my eyes and told her to unpack and to try somehow to explain to our 11-year-old daughter that she couldn't go along with me. And I'm sure you all are aware as to how very disappointed they were that they couldn't be with me here this evening. And they were extremely disappointed. I talked to them earlier this evening on the phone, and Mrs. Hughes asked me especially, though you're not acquainted with her, she also is one of those angels that have lived with a hell of a drunk for a lot of years. And to these ladies that have gone through this, there is nothing that could possibly repay them. So we certainly like to extend our appreciation and their thoughts when it's at all possible. At the beginning, I always like to start a talk because, as I told Maury tonight, I said, you know, Maury, I haven't any script. I don't actually know what I'm going to say. And he said, you can't scare me this late in the program. That's all there is to it. So, if you would just bow your head a moment with me in silent prayer, in the thought that whatever is said here tonight might reach some needing heart somewhere, sometime. come in. You know, many years ago, and I, like so many of you that are alcoholics and those that are friends of AA and have sought some answers to it over the years, I don't know yet why I'm an alcoholic, but I do know that I am an alcoholic. And I guess that's the most important thing. I am not going to spend a great deal of time this evening in talking to you about my particular drinking patterns. I think they fit in with all of the patterns of most of the drinkers. I would like to, however, just express a little of my background to you so that you might better understand me as a person and what I am talking about. I was never a normal drinker in my life. Like many of you, I started drinking in my teens. Never did I drink normally. From the first time I took a drink, I was an abnormal drinker. And over the years, I progressed into continuously drinking more and more until I reached my particular low, my particular bottom. And I had realized for many years before I finally admitted defeat that I had to find a way out of this mess, but I wasn't ready to admit that I couldn't drink. I was one of those people, like so many of us are, that had to try and be the best at everything I did. As a youth in school, I wanted to do everything better than everyone else to the best of my ability. I had to always prove myself. I tried to prove my manhood and my ability to compete in everything that I was involved in. I went through the natural courses at 15 years of age. I was an athlete back in Iowa, as some Iowans might happen to remember, some 25 years ago. And at that time, I thought I had a great career ahead of me in athletics. I wanted to be an All-American, and I worked hard at it. And I did become an All-American. I became an All-American drunk, like so many of us have. I explained it somewhat this way in talking to the very lovely lady next to me at the dinner table, that during the last few years that I drank, I became increasingly ornerier every month that went by, and I got meaner by the hour, more or less. It got to the point in my hometown that when I walked in a bar, anybody with good sense either left the place or got far away from me. And a man of my size and my strength, and the people gradually learned that it didn't take much to upset me, and if they might speak to me kindly, I might interpret it wrong. And thinking they were making fun of me, you know, and hurt someone. But the county sheriff knew me quite well. He took me home rather than to jail most of the time, though like many of you, I've spent some nights in jail in my life, too. And my pattern, I believe, is about the same. Through the war years, my drinking grew progressively worse, though there were times I couldn't get something to drink, and during those times I was sober, but when I could, I drank the vino in Africa and the whatever it was in Italy. I haven't figured that out yet. Tasted like gasoline with baking soda in it, but I could lose my memory with it, whatever it was. That champagne they used to sell over there and the scotch, you know. I was talking to Mr. Bailey tonight, one of your distinguished guests here, and he noted that I had a steak for dinner rather than the chicken that the rest of you had. And you here in California may not have heard it, but we in the Middle West are suffering a great depression of beef prices. And I have to do everything I can to consume all the beef I can wherever I go. So I insisted that my aide have beef tonight, too. That's his excuse out there at that table. But believe me, it has been meant a great deal to me over the years to see the people of my home state gradually realize, and I realized, ladies and gentlemen, that there was no use for me to try and conceal the fact that I'm an alcoholic. So many people try and conceal the fact, and I don't know how they think they can, that they are an alcoholic or that they have been heavy drinkers, because everyone in their community knew it, and many miles around, and in my particular instance, all over the state. And in recent years, my trying to protect my anonymity has been somewhat of a problem for me, though I do believe in the preservation of the anonymity of a person in Alcoholics Anonymous unless they themselves choose to identify themselves as a member of this particular group or as an alcoholic, and at what particular level they may choose to do so. I think this is very important, because there are many people who, for personal and business reasons, must maintain their anonymity continuously. So over a period of time, I refused constantly to ever allow my name to be used at a level of press, radio, or television as a member of this particular fellowship. But the News Corps all have known about it. When I first entered politics as a candidate many years ago, I decided that the only way I could handle this problem was to call our press corps together and tell them the truth, because I knew they would find out the truth very soon if I didn't. So I called them together and I told them the entire story. And of the years I had spent in AA and working with an NAA, and I asked them to respect my anonymity as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And to this day, the Iowa Press Corps has done that. They have never mentioned it. But it has been written in Time magazine, and it has been written in... in a number of other national publications, so I don't know what the hell's the use trying any longer. But I believe in this because it is one of the tenets of the organization. Not for myself. I certainly believe that there are many times that when people who are yet struggling with the convulsions of the elbow can look and see someone who has had some measure of success in conquering the problem and can relate themselves with that person, that they sometimes feel they can find a way out of the horrible mess they are in. And there is a way out, and sometimes it works by different nature. I would like to tell you how I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's one of the strangest that I have ever heard in all of the many stories I've heard over the years. You know, I quit drinking several times, just as I've quit smoking several times, and I'm still going through about 2.5 packs a day now. This recent report on smoking, incidentally, did raise hell with things for me. Instead of 3 packs of cigarettes, I'm going through at least 2 packs and 6 cigars and a pipe now. It's kind of like what they tell you about taking a man or a woman to an AA meeting. They may not quit, but they sure as hell aren't happy about it anymore. If you just get them. The real thing, though, is that I believe most assuredly that we have had great good fortune, and I would like to say in AA, my getting into AA, that I had quit several times, once for 3 months, once for 6 months, and one time I quit drinking for 14 months. And I thought I had it made, like so many people that have had the slips, say. So I decided that I was a social drinker again, and I'd have a couple of highballs, and that would be it. And I started out that way, a couple of highballs. And one day I woke up with a half a case of whiskey in the room and 2 cases of pop. I looked at my watch and it was about 10 o'clock. decided I'd better find out where the hell I was at, so I called the desk and they told me what city I was in. I called my wife and said, "Honey, I'll be home today. I've got time to make it yet. If I just hurry, I overslept this morning." And she said, "You damn fool, it's night, not morning." And so I looked at the bottle, and I was as sick as a billy goat on a Sunday morning, and I decided that something had to be done. And I struggled through the night and got up in the morning, and between 22 stops getting sick on the way home the next day, I made up my mind I'd had it, and that something had to be done, or I was completely destroying myself, and there must be a way out of this for me some way. So I knew I had to quit, and I'd heard a lot about Alcoholics Anonymous, but I thought it was for the bums and the people that couldn't take care of themselves. And I didn't class myself in that category, you know. It's always the guy next to you on the barroom stool that's an alcoholic, not you yourself. So I tried it. For a miserable year and a half, I was sober. And it was the most miserable year and a half, I think, of my life. I was meaner and ornerier and nastier, probably, than I was when I was drunk. And then a father of a good friend of mine came to me and said, "Pack," which is my nickname back home, "my son is going to lose his job. His wife is going to leave him. He's got two wonderful children. You're not drinking. Can you talk to him and get him to quit?" I said, "I don't know, but I'll try." So I went and talked to him, and he wasn't about to do anything like that. And I said, "Well, why don't we go to an AA meeting? I'd never been to one myself." And he said, "Hell, I'm not like those people. I can quit any time I want to." And I said, "Well, maybe you're not." But I said, "Why don't we go? You don't think you're any better than I am, do you?" He said, "Why, no, of course not. I'm no better than you are." And I said, "Well, then we'll go together. I'll pick you up at 7 o'clock. There's a meeting over at Storm Lake, and we'll drive over there. It's about 40 miles away. There wasn't a group in my hometown." He called me about 6 and made 16 excuses why he couldn't go. And I said, "I'm going to be there at 7 with a baseball bat, and you better be ready." And he was ready, and we went to the meeting. And you'd be surprised at how many old drinking friends I met at that meeting. People I knew had quit, and I never knew why. And they just held out their arms like this when I walked in the door. The lost is home, you know. And I kind of told them in a one-sided way that it wasn't me that was there. I was there. I had brought a friend that needed the program. Well, I sat through it, and you know, every one of those darn fools looked right at me every word they said. By the time the meeting was over, I kind of got the point. They thought I needed the program, too, and I was highly insulted. I got a hold of my friend, and I said, "To hell with this bunch of nuts. We're going home and never coming back." And we went home, and the strangest thing happened. You know, the next morning, there was two of those guys sitting with me for coffee. And about an hour later, another one came by the office and said, "Don't you think we ought to go down and have another cup of coffee?" Before the day was over, they were coming in ones and twos and threes. And I wondered if they had forgotten my friend. But to make a long story short, I was back at the next meeting with two of my other friends. And I've been going back ever since. In the next meeting, I more or less got the point. I made up my mind I better listen to something that was said. You know how the first one or two meetings are? You're in a thorough state of confusion. Well, I went through the whole series that all of you have gone through. After about 2 years, I was on the pink cloud, you know, and I went out to dry up the world. Everybody that I thought was taking one or two too many, I called on him and looked him right in the eye and said, "How you doing with your drinking?" You'd be amazed how many times I got told to mind my own damn business. After getting bruised and bloodied so much that I didn't get anybody, I decided, I wonder what the hell this 12-step work is anyway, you know. They want you to go out. I was about ready to get drunk. Well, I went back and talked to a man who had been on the program then about 10 or 11 years. He's now dead. And I told him what my situation was, and we went back and went through the big book again, and he kind of pointed out to me where I was in the program. You know, they'd explained it to me so many times, they'd gone over my head so much, and I thought I knew everything there was to know about Alcoholics Anonymous. And now, some 11 years later, I realize how little I really know about this program. There are as many different ways to work this program, ladies and gentlemen, as there are members in the fellowship itself. And what may help you or any one alcoholic may not help the next person. These 12 steps which you heard read here tonight are suggested steps. I've heard it said many times that you can take what you want and you can leave the rest. But I personally believe that unless you do work and continuously work and continuously try to progress with these steps, that you miss the overall total point of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I realize that it's a never-ending project, but it never should end for you and I, because we have spent a great part of our lifetime in destroying ourselves, and we did destroy ourselves and our family. I am among those whose wife has filed inebriation charges against him also. I've sat in the courtrooms, and I've seen my children look at me with fear in their eyes after they got old enough to know what was the matter. My two older children, at least. And bringing that to mind, incidentally, I would have to comment, one of the nicest things that ever happened to me in my life happened about 2 years ago. My youngest daughter, who is 11 years old now, said to me, "Dad, you never drank in your life, did you?" And I looked at her and I said, "Why, honey, you've been to AA meetings with me many times and heard me talk about meetings, and I've taken my children with me all the time, the two older girls as well as the younger one, while they were home." And yet it hadn't soaked into her mind, because she has never seen me take a drink in her life. And what a wonderful thing that is for me, to know that at least one of my children have at least never known me when I was the animal that I was when I was drinking. I commented here tonight that I am afraid to drink. And I am afraid to drink. I'm scared to death of it. I said also that I don't have any great desire for it anymore, and I don't. In my present position, as I'm sure you're well aware, the booze flows freely all over and constantly. Cocktail parties are a must at all levels of government, you know. This is the way most of the business is carried out while you're half boozed up. And I might add at this point, if there is anyone here from the press or radio or television, that I am not giving permission to repeat anything I say here tonight. Well, I decided that scared to death of liquor, and I knew I was scared because, as so many of you, I had thought so many times of destroying myself that I actually got to the point I was afraid I would do it when I didn't know what I was doing. Now, this is funny, but it's serious, by golly, for you people that have blacked out, as I have blacked out. In the last few years, I drank many times. I never remembered ever taking the first drink. I never knew when I started or even where I started. I was ashamed to walk down the main street of my hometown because people would smile at me and say, "You had a hell of a time last night, didn't you?" And I didn't know whether I had an awful time or not. I've got up many a morning and crawled to the window and looked out to see if the car was there. And if it wasn't, I was scared to death. And if it was, I was scared to death. I'd go out and look and see if I'd hit anything or where I'd been. I finally got to the point where I knew I couldn't drive when I was drinking. So the minute I started drinking, I'd give the keys to somebody and say, "Don't give them back to me no matter what." Then after I was two-thirds drunk, I'd go to them and say, "Give me the keys or I'll beat the hell out of you." The same old split personality of an alcoholic. So finally, after these meetings, and after several years in AA, and after going through the bruises and the bumps of trying to help those to recover who didn't want to recover, I developed the philosophy of Alcoholics Anonymous and decided that perhaps I better really start through this program myself. And this was a number of years after I had been attending meetings. So I went back and I started all over again, and I started to reason my way through all of this and as to what the purpose was that these two great men had got together in initiating this program, and the people that worked out this book that gave you and I what we have today and their stories and reasoning power, and what had brought them to their real reason and their real sense, and what drove them on in an attempt to give this program to those yet ailing people in this world, to what they really believed in and what they thought and what they had to hang on to, and the only thing they had to hang on to. And I decided that the basic thing itself, though you have read it all, was characterized in those 12 steps that were handed down to us and that were set out here as a suggested program of recovery. And those words that said that those that have honestly taken these 12 steps seldom fail. And I believe this. Because one of the most difficult things that I had to admit was that I was powerless over alcohol. I knew damn well that my life was unmanageable, totally unmanageable when I was drinking, but I wouldn't admit I was powerless over alcohol. But I finally did. I finally was beat to my knees and beaten and realized that I was totally powerless over alcohol and that I couldn't control it. The great human ego that's in all alcoholics and will not let them give up and admit defeat finally defeated me also, and I said, "I can't handle it. I know it. I'm defeated, and I've got to find another way." So then I was able to go ahead and to see the second step, which said I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. And in thinking my way through this particular step, I decided that if I had to be restored to sanity, then it infers that I'm insane, at least when I'm drinking. And when I thought about my drinking, I suddenly realized that I was insane. That any category of description that any psychiatrist could put out, I couldn't pass the sanity examination when I was drinking. And that if I could believe in a power greater than myself, that it would help restore me, then I must find that power, whatever it might be. And I've always said to those people that it's time that we in AA visualize this power greater than ourselves, as I visualize it as God. I ask all of those in AA to Visualize with me, just mentally at least for a moment, how you envision your God and what you think of when you think of God. And who is God? And why is God? And where is God? And how is He with me here and now? And how is this power that's greater than ourselves going to help us? Well, if you accept the God, and God as you understand Him, not as I understand Him, then you take the third step and you make a decision to turn your will and your life over to the care of that God as you understand Him. Or you turn your life over to your God as you understand Him. And you believe in your heart that God can take this life and do with it what He will. And that I will follow the directions as I'm able to understand them. And to turn your will over to it. And this doesn't mean that you can reserve any area of your will, ladies and gentlemen. It doesn't mean that in some far little corner of your spirit, or your mind, or your soul, that you're going to keep this almighty ego that's been driving you into oblivion all of these years and reserve that one bit of hatred that is you enjoy hating so much. But you say that my will is now surrendered also, as well as my life. Where do I go? Show me the way. And believe me, if you just sit down in the chair and wait, your beard will get long, your clothes will get old, and you'll rot. Just exactly like buying a new car, parking it at the curb, not putting any gas in it, going out and jumping in the back seat and saying, take me somewhere. You're not going anywhere. You've got to put gas in the car, you've got to get behind the wheel, you've got to know how to operate it, and you've got to drive it to a point of destination. So you must ascertain with your God as you understand Him where you are going. And then in step number four, you made a fearless and searching moral inventory of yourself. I won't dwell on that much because it's dwelled on in the steps many times. But this inventory, as you all know, takes in the good as well as the bad, the assets as well as the debits. We do not balance these off. We do not say that one offsets the other, that all of these good points offset all of the bad points. We simply say that these are our good and our bad points, and we recognize them for what they are. We recognize that we have some good points, and we recognize that we have some bad points. Now, what are we going to do about both? You try and eliminate the bad and increase the good, naturally. With step number five, we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. And this may take years and years and years. Our wrongs, many times, ladies and gentlemen, have been wrongs of omission rather than wrongs of commission. Our wrongs have been dereliction of our own obligations to society and our family and our children and our loved ones and to the human race itself. It's been one of self-destruction, headlong and hell-bent. But we have admitted naturally to ourselves many of these wrongs. We gradually admit them to another human being. Not always all of them. Many people, including myself, have did so many dirty, lousy, rotten things in their life that they can't find it within themselves to tell another human being the exact nature of all their wrongs. But they can admit it to God and to themselves, and most generally do. We're entirely ready to have God remove all of these defects of character in step six. And I'd like to have you stop for a minute and think with me. Are you really, you alcoholics, ready to allow God, if suddenly here and now with a bolt of lightning, he could remove every defect of character you have, would you willingly give it up? Just think with me for a moment, if you would, seriously. I doubt it very much. Because you enjoy some of these defects. Really, you do. All of us do. Then we humbly ask him to remove our shortcomings. Well, how do you ask God to do anything? There's only one way I know how to communicate with God. And that's through prayer. And if you will not pray, then you cannot communicate. And this does not mean, and I'm a Methodist, so I can say this, that you have to be long-winded like some Methodist preachers that I've heard. But it simply means that even a prayer of desperation, and where a man in total desperation just says, "Oh God, help me." And it can be the mightiest prayer on the face of the earth if it comes from the soul and not from a false attitude. But if you ask God to remove these shortcomings, then it means you have communication with God. Well, what do you have to do to have communication with God? You know, I had this explained to me, too. I made a long search, ladies and gentlemen, in all of these things, and over the years, how could I communicate with God? Well, one time, Father, a counselor and a pastor explained it to me. He said, you know, the human body, in many ways, so you can understand it, I'd like to explain it like a radio or a television set. Both, perhaps, a receiving and a transmitter. You receive communications from God, and you transmit communications to God. But many times there is static, and the picture is fuzzy, and the snow is falling. So what do? You have to adjust the set and get rid of the static. But how do you do this? Well, this is what we're doing. All the years of our lives, you and I have been covering up the very center of our spirit and our soul. And the way it's been best explained to me is if you would mentally visualize the head of a cabbage or a head of lettuce. We were born, more or less, not without sin naturally, but we had not contributed to it greatly. So as we progressed through life, and our heart was covered and our soul was covered with a new leaf of sin, of the terrible things we had done, insulating our heart and our soul and our spirit from God as we understood him. And all of these years as we went by, we added new leaves onto this until we had reached this breaking point where there was almost total insulation between us and God, and there was no way of communication. So what did we have to do? We had to remove the leaves. And how did we remove the leaves of insulation? Well, we removed them by taking the 12 steps. We came to believe first that the power could do it. Then we made the decision to let him do it. And then we asked him to do it. Then we made the inventory. And then we tore them off, one by one by one by one, until we had gone down the line again. We had removed the insulation, and the receiving set was again clear. And prayers again could be transmitted. And prayers could be heard and directions followed. We made a list of all the persons we'd harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Now, this has value. For a long time, I wondered, what the heck is this point in here for? But you know, the therapy of just getting a piece of paper and writing down all of the wrongs you did is good if you do nothing more than wad it up and throw it away. But I'd suggest you burn it. Somebody might look in the wastebasket. But just to put them down. And then if you carry out the rest of it and really go out and make amends, where possible, except, of course, in this step, when to do so would injure other people or yourself tremendously. You know, I found out when I got to this point that I had been carrying some hatred in my heart for one man for so long that it was one of the great joys that I had. I enjoyed hating him. And I could just think about him and how I'd like to punch him in the nose and get great satisfaction out of it. You know, I said, Mr. Hughes, if you believe in this program, you're going to go to that man and tell him you forgive him, and that bygones are bygones, and if there's any more hatred or bitterness, it's going to be one way. And I didn't think I could do it. I mean it. But I made myself do it. And I went to him, and I told him what I was there for, why I had come, that I was sorry there had been bitterness between us, and that perhaps I had contributed to it. And for the next 30 minutes, I listened to a pedigree of myself that I never knew anything about before. He called me everything in the book, and I have a very good vocabulary on that side of the ledger, too. And I said I was sorry he felt that way, and I left. And by the time I got to the bottom of the stairs, he beat me down on the elevator, and he met me. He had his hand out, and he had tears in his eyes, and he said he was sorry. And I'm afraid I had tears in my eyes, too. And to this day, he and I are friends. And even now, I'm not real sure what I was mad at him about. You know, it's hard to believe, but it's true. Step number 10, we continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, we promptly admitted. And this is necessary, I decided, after many years, because, you know, I suddenly was getting more important, and I was realizing how important I was, and you got to deflate yourself occasionally, you know. Well, my wife does this continuously, but we need to do it ourselves. So I try never to go to bed at night without reviewing the day, to think what I have done wrong to someone else. And you know, I haven't found a day yet that I haven't done something wrong to someone else. Strange, but if you stop and think, you'll find it. And being human, we make mistakes. All of us in all positions. Some of them very serious mistakes. Some of them we think almost unforgivable. And some of them we wonder how on earth we could have done it. And yet we do do it. But it's not too late. And God, as you understand him, can understand. People will understand with time. And most assuredly, if you believe as I do in an eternity, then we're looking at something else. But it is time daily to take this inventory and to keep those leaves of insulation from our spirit and our soul, and to be able to commune with God clearly and directly, and to ask his wishes and his guidance. And we go on through step 11. Seeking through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understand him. And this is important. Praying only for knowledge of his will for us in the power to carry that out. This is one of the great and important things. If you can ask God to say, what is my purpose in life? Why am I here? Is it only to take up a bit of space for a period of 70 years to die and disappear again? or is the purpose in life for each and every one of us? You never know at what point in history any man walking the face of this earth might be the most important creation in the history of the race itself. The contact that he might make could be the one contact that would turn the course of history itself. And they're all important. There isn't a man or a woman anywhere that is not important in the eyes of God, as I understand it. We cannot fail to reach our hand down and even to walk down if necessary and walk back with him if it's possible. And these things can be done if we ask and seek the guidance and the knowledge and the wisdom of God to direct us in the way he would have us to go. Step number 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, and this you will note, ladies and gentlemen, that it says that if you have taken these other 11 steps, you have had a spiritual awakening. Now, what is a spiritual awakening? What is a spirit? What's the spirit of anything? What's the spirit of AA? What's the old high school spirit, the old college spirit? And what is this spiritual awakening? And what do you think it is? It isn't something that perhaps you think would happen like a flash of lightning, like happened to Paul, and suddenly, by some mighty wave of action, God has revealed to you your purpose and you know where you're going. To most people, it comes so slowly that they never recognize it. Like an education in school, you start in kindergarten, you progress slowly through the grades and on through college, and at what point do you have enough knowledge to say that you can speak with wisdom? There's much difference between knowledge and wisdom. You will notice it when people start saying to you that you never expected to, "My, you have changed." And it will please you, and it should. We try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. You know, I can tell you a secret here in California, that this is the way I confuse my enemies in politics. They've been trying for years to figure out what my angles are when I do something. And the only angle I have in any of this is to carry out the will of God as I understand it. And many of my decisions are based on this and nothing else. And it is confusing to people who are looking for angles. And among a group of the greatest angle shooters in the world, you know what I'm talking about. What an order, but you can go through with it. And life can be beautiful, but do you know something? This will not take the pain out of life. It will not take the sorrow out of life. It will not take the struggle out of life, but it will put hope in life. It will put a permanence in life. And it will help you on into eternity with sobriety and love and understanding and, above all, the respect of your family, your friends, and your neighbors. Thank you very much, Lee.